Oh, let's go.
It is time for a bonus, a jackpot Friday choke point. Sully is here to tell us why the lane markings on I-5 in Fife are now orange.
Yeah, they are orange. And Colleen, I'll ask you about this in a minute, because this orange paint job debuted yesterday morning, and it's going to remain in place until the fall. The Washington Department of Transportation and the Federal Highway Administration want to know if adding orange to the lanes inside construction work zones will make drivers pay better attention. Tom Slimak is the WashDOT project engineer for this work zone in Fife. WashDOT didn't paint all the stripes or over the stripes. They just added some orange paint to the stripes.
Everybody's typically used to seeing skip stripes, right, that delineate the lanes. What we've done is we've augmented that with an immediate preceding orange stripe.
So half the stripe is white, the other half is orange. You can check out the pictures at mynorthwest.com. Colleen, what did you think when you first saw them?
I loved it. It was colorful and fun, and I didn't need to be told I was in a construction zone, because you see the orange and that just triggers in you, hey, I'm in a construction zone, and it's clearer when you enter and when you exit it.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, because pretty soon the orange is gone. And you're like, oh, I must be out of it.
But
instead of looking
pretty.
For barrels or whatever on the side of the road.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, good. So when I first heard that WashDOT was doing this, I assumed it might paint the fog lines and everything inside the zone.
It's needed.
Well, you know, and I don't know. And that's the thing. That's what this was about, because this is a pilot project to see what kind of paint jobs work or don't work, or how much they have to do or how little they have to do. So
it's so striking with just the dotted lines, and especially since there's so many lanes there, that you could paint the fog line, but it's really not neat. Like, it's dramatic enough and makes a statement enough that just the stripes are fine.
All right, so I asked Slimak about it.
If we just did the lane lines, do we get better compliance with speeds? Is there better lane assignment through the work zone, enhancing that work zone safety?
And as I mentioned, this is a pilot project, so WashDOT decided to go this way first, and it might try something different next time.
We'll just have to see what the data tells us and then see what kind of conclusions we can draw. Was this beneficial? Should we maybe look to something else?
Slimak mentioned data here. WashDOT is going to track how this paint job impacts driver behavior, or if it does. It's installing cameras inside the work zone to monitor how people are driving, and then a driver survey is going to be put up asking for your feedback.
Coming up here in July, there'll be a public survey, and we want the public to comment. Give us the feedback. What did you feel like when you were going through the work zone? Did you notice it? Did you slow down? Did you notice our work zone and our workers out there?
This will determine whether or not you might see orange paint popping up in other work zones around the state. Now, this is the first time that this has been tried in Washington. Four other states are doing it too.
And this is just another potential, what we call tool in our toolbox for work zones. And there's signs and other type of measures that we can try. Is this a low cost solution? Some paint, simple paint on the roadway, does that enhance the worker safety, the safety of the traveling public going through our work zones?
If you've driven through the area, you can always give us your thoughts on the State Roofing text line, 888-973-5476. The pictures should be up at mynorthwest.com. I hope our web team is doing that. If not, you can see it at NewsGuySully on my Twitter page as well. I took some photos, and I can also, if you want to, I can just show them to you. I'll hold them up to the camera off of my phone.
Yeah, there you go.
I like it.
I liked it, honestly. And I know we talked about this a little bit this morning, where I said it made me more aware I was in a construction zone. You were like, you mean the big, like, cranes and digging? Didn't? And I argue that, like, okay, but if you're driving a long distance and you're listening to a podcast or Seattle's Morning News, whatever, like, sometimes you can get so engrossed in what you're listening to that you're in the construction, and you're like, huh, and you have to slow. And I get it. Like, listen, don't come at me. We all get distracted. We all get engrossed in our own thoughts and we forget. This made me feel like I was actually in the construction zone. Not the construction zone was on my periphery, and not, this made me feel like, okay, I'm actually driving through a construction zone because the orange was in my territory.
Okay, good. Yeah, and
does
visible.
That make sense?
Yeah, I'm with you. And again, this is only a little mile stretch of the road.
Sure.
So yeah, it was interesting. I was just expecting more when they were like, hey, we're painting the freeway. I was like, hey, all right, let's see what we got. So subtle but effective, I think, is what you're telling me.
I kind of would love it if, like, different cities and counties would choose a color. So it's like, now you're in Fife and it's yellow. Now you're in.
That's going to be way
green.
Too confusing.
I know, but this is me wanting to, like, paint the town with color,
because
I thought it was pretty. It's construction orange, but it was like a nice treat as I was driving. Like, ooh.
something different other than just construction through Pierce County.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yes.
Right, I mean, which hasn't happened in months.
Yeah. Although I will tell you,
in months.
Some of those S-curve jogs that they create in those construction zones are quite jarring for
drivers. That's why the speed is down to 50 miles an hour through that and in a couple other places. Yeah, just you got to be safe through those.
And
they're just about to do some, you know, some jogging coming up. I talked about the choke point earlier by the Kent Des Moines Road. That's going to be really jarring. Mm. Where I told you, you're going to be driving in the other side of the freeway.
Yeah.
Coming up. So, yeah, let's all. Paying attention is key during our construction season.
Hopefully this helps. Thanks, Ole.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
Our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us Friday mornings for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind local places and things. And this week, it was right after the end of World War II in 1945 when civic leaders and local charities built a giant welcome home sign in Magnolia to greet veterans as they returned to Seattle by ship.
Good morning, Travis. Yeah,
morning.
I love old signs, especially ones that aren't here anymore, and especially giant ones I've never heard of before. That's what we're talking about today. Now, you know Discovery Park in Magnolia and the famously photogenic West Point Lighthouse from 1881? Well, just north and east of there, along the shoreline of West Point, a giant sign was built 78 years ago this autumn to point out into the waterway to be seen by passing ships. And when I say giant, I mean giant. It was made of plywood, I think. It was about 20 feet tall and something like 270 feet long. This is a big sign.
Wow, yeah.
Had a version of the state seal at each end, the big George Washington head. And it said in giant white letters on a blue background, "Welcome home." The whole thing was illuminated by floodlights and was said to be visible anywhere from 6 to 15 miles at sea. Now, the idea was that hundreds of thousands of veterans would be coming through what was called the Seattle Port of Embarkation after the war ended. Not sure how many vets returned through Seattle when all was said and done, but more than a half million shipped out of here during the war. And by as early as February of 1946, that same number, a half million, had already returned through our port. Now, the sign was apparently the idea of then-Governor Mon Walgren. Total cost was $9,000, with the state paying half, and after the Seattle City Council backed out, boo, of paying their half, a Seattle group called the War Athletic Council raised the rest from private donors. Total would be about $160,000 in today's money. Now, construction began in November 1945 and was completed sometime that month. It was like a giant billboard, essentially. Now, as this is the Northwest, the otherwise innocent gesture was apparently rife with controversy. A photo photo in the Seattle Times of Seattle Mayor William Devon standing in front of the sign is said to have irked Governor Walgren, because it made it look like Devon was responsible for it. And of course, Tacoma was jealous of state funding for a sign in Seattle, though the governor said it was meant as a welcome to anyone coming to Washington, because any ship headed to Tacoma would pass by it as well. It wasn't just welcome to Seattle, it said welcome home, with a big George Washington head on it. Now, one thing I can't figure out is how long the sign stood there, how long it was illuminated. I've searched through all kinds of archives and looked at old charts, the old Coast Pilot, the guidebook for mariners published by the government. You might remember another giant sign, the Port of Seattle neon sign on Elliott Bay. That was so visible, it was actually shown on nautical charts and mentioned in the Coast Pilot as a good marker of the city. But I don't know how long the sign in Magnolia actually was illuminated. And I went out to West Point yesterday to see if there's any evidence remaining of the old sign. I didn't do an exhaustive search, didn't bring a shovel or any metal detectors or anything, but I couldn't see any obvious clues. Now, we have some very cool photos of this, which were shared with me by the Coast Guard Museum here in Seattle, that show the sign and the lighthouse and give a really good sense of how giant it was. Those will be posted later at My Northwest.
Felix, thank you. I'm seeing at least one of the photos over on your Twitter page as well. It is, when you see the people in the photos, how big it really is.
The letters are like 18 feet high, the sign's 25. It's huge.
Yeah, gigantic. Back to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Travis Mayfield in for Dave Ross, along with Colleen O'Brien. And Sully is, of course, at the traffic desk. We have crossed into uncharted legal and historical grounds with the federal criminal indictment of a former president, but it is uncharted political grounds as well. We turn now to anchor of CBS News Primetime and fill-in moderator of Face the Nation, John Dickerson. John, this indictment, a political earthquake, or am I misreading this situation?
It's good to be with you, Travis. It is a political earthquake. The reason you're skeptical is that we've heard that so much. And one of the challenges during the Trump era has been when everything is always at the number 10 on a scale of 1 to 10, it's hard to find the language to talk about when you get to 11. But the indictment of the first federal indictment of a former president is a big deal. What's at the heart of this case, which is the most sensitive secrets of the U.S. government, is a big deal. The obstruction at the heart of this case is a big deal in a country that fancies that no one is above the law. If you've been subpoenaed, you can't ignore the subpoena, or worse, you can't say you've complied with the subpoena and lie when you have not complied with the subpoena. So those are all very serious things. And so this is now. That's the legal situation. The question is, politically, does the party that former President Trump is the head of and the clear front runner in the next presidential contest, does it react by rallying around him or treating this as something different? That has yet to be determined. And that will determine whether it, in fact, is a political earthquake in the sense of reshaping the power structure of one of America's two major parties.
I mean, that's my big question. Who I keep watching are all of his primary rivals and then sitting members of Congress, folks maybe who in the past have defended him. Do they walk up to the point of actually defending him, or do they only walk up to the point of pointing at the investigation and saying they don't like it, or do they go after him? I mean, you have some of his GOP rivals booked for the show this weekend. Are you going to ask him, I assume, about this?
I will. And, you know, one of the problems is that and this has been true of the Trump presidency in general, is that his style of behavior creates such a an amount of conversation. You can't ignore the first indictment, the federal indictment of a former president. On the other hand, it means you can't talk to these other candidates about other important issues that actually affect the daily lives of the American people. And we're going to try to get through some of that. But I'm going to talk to Chris Sununu, the governor of New Hampshire, who decided not to run, but who obviously has influence in that key first primary state. And then Doug Burgum is the governor of North Dakota, who's a super long shot, but an interesting person, a very successful businessman, came from he was a chimney sweep and built a business, has a really interesting take on the challenges with American politics.
I keep reading pundits this morning, maybe folks who, after the original indictment in New York over the hush money paid to the porn star, were like, meh, that case seems a little flimsy. Folks this morning seem to be taking this case a little more seriously. Is that how you're reading things as well?
I think so. I haven't surveyed the analysis out there, but I think there is reason to do that for a couple of points. The New York District Attorney's case was something that happened in the past. It had the porn star aspect of it. Frankly, one of the ways in which Donald Trump has changed American politics is being alleged to have had an affair with a porn star ain't what it used to be.
Right. And it didn't just derail anything to begin with. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. It's priced into the market, as they say, on the business channels. And also the crime that he's alleged to have committed in New York is a kind of a lying about business accounting, lying again in a system that relies on people telling the truth is no small thing. So I don't mean to dismiss it. But in this case, it's not only lying, but lying about some of the most sensitive things in U.S. national security. It's lying in the teeth of a subpoena, which is an instrument of law that's used to make sure people comply with the law, because you can't, again, have lawlessness. And also, I think in this case, there's a narrative aspect of it that makes it more immediately understandable. And that's not just a kind of theater review point, but there are audio tapes, transcripts of the president, of his lawyers, talking about the specifics of this case. One of the things we know that the prosecutor has is audio tape of the president saying, "I have this material. It's secret." In other words, he knew that it was secret. He knew he shouldn't be sharing it.
That was CBS News correspondent John Dickerson. Wall Street feeling bullish again. S&P rallying yesterday, ending the day in bull market territory, marking a 20% surge since its most recent low, reached on October 12th, 2022, which brings us to the end of the bear market that began in January of 2022. So joining us now to explain this bull market, CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, thank you very much for joining us. We know we kind of just called you up. Colleen was like, "We got to get Jill on the line."
No, I love me some Jill, and I need her to explain bull market.
You know, these are arbitrary markers, but I don't know. They mean something. They're milestones. So we define a bull market as a 20% rise from the recent low point, and the bear market is a 20% decline. And I think because of your sensitivity to the technology sector, mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say that the bear market in technology stocks started before the overall market. So for the tech sector, we're really talking about the fall of 2021, when those markets reached new highs and then tumbled by dramatic levels, you know, sometimes 50, 60, 70%. And then the rest of the market followed. And since then, I think this year has been fascinating simply because everybody came into the year saying, oh, it's going to be a recession. We've got the Fed raising interest rates. Companies can't make money. The poor tech sector is bleeding jobs. And then something strange happened. It didn't all pan out that way, which is one of the reasons I love covering this beat, because even when you get a whole bunch of experts agreeing on what will happen next, sometimes that doesn't happen. So we had more buyers than sellers. We had technology sector really ramping up. And right now we are in the beginning phases potentially of a bull market. Now, I don't know how long it could last. We could slide back into a bear market tomorrow. But for today, the news is a good one if you own stocks.
How did this get triggered, though, especially since, as you mentioned, the tech industry has been bleeding jobs? Is it because of the layoffs that we're now entering this bull market?
Well, I think the tech sector took control very quickly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you go back in time and you think to that first moment where Mark Zuckerberg got up and said, I made a mistake. I spent too much money. I hired too many people. That was just the first announcement. But the tech sector started getting their headcount under control, stopped spending as much money. Then we saw similar moves from technology to financial services to media, those three areas in particular. But the rest of the economy was doing okay. And don't forget, we have a lot of consumers who, although they are kind of freaked out and spooked by inflation, they continue to spend pretty robustly. I think the surprising aspect of where we are right now, as we are almost at the midpoint of 23, is that the economy is doing as well as it's done. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that inflation is starting to come down. We see that in lots of different areas. And that consumers are pretty resilient. Part of that has to do with many people locking in low mortgage rates. Part of that has to do with people getting raises. And part of it has to do that the economy is more than one, two, or three sectors. So it's very difficult for anyone to say, hey, I think we're heading into a recession, when the economy has produced 339,000 jobs last month and 341,000 jobs a month for the last 12 months.
Now, just quickly, does this mean, as you know, because you know, around here in the Seattle area, tech is, you know, a lot of people's employers. Does it mean those layoffs are going to be slowing down and the health of the companies may just stay afloat?
Well, I mean, first of all, they are healthy companies, especially these mega cap technology stocks, you know, whether it's Microsoft or Amazon or Apple. But I think that the idea of AI has re-energized the sector in such a major way. And in when I speak to folks who are following the sector and looking at this information, they really are saying this is something that could be transformative. And so there is money, there is energy. I do think the worst is probably over for the technology sector. And again, if you've lost your job and you're in tech, I'm sorry, it stinks. I get that. But it does appear that for now that the worst is probably over. It doesn't mean that other sectors won't feel the pinch, but it's clear to me that for so many aspects of the economy that were looking like they were going to roll over, things have gotten a lot better. And the worst case scenario has not panned out. And by the way, I'm a woman who loves to plan for a worst case scenario, so I'm more shocked than anyone else.
That's why we called you, Jill. Appreciate you joining us on the fly here.
Take care.
It is 7:16 now on Seattle's Morning News. We're joined by Travis Mayfield. Lots of love for you on the text line this morning,
that's
Travis.
So nice.
People loving your enthusiasm. And I agree. Travis is wonderful. He's in for Dave Ross, and Sully is here for traffic. I'm Colleen O'Brien. CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy joins us now on this stunning information that a former president for the first time is facing federal criminal charges. Good morning, Stephen.
Hey, good morning. Former President Trump is due in a Miami federal courthouse next Tuesday afternoon to stand before a judge and hear the charges against him. It's a 7-count indictment, which remains under seal, so we haven't actually read it yet. It's reported that the charges are involved with the retention of classified or other sensitive national security information in violation of the Espionage Act, making false statements, conspiring to obstruct justice and obstruct the investigation, the efforts to get those documents back in government hands. The former president released this news on social media last night, got ahead of it, and put out a video in which he said he's an innocent man. And he accused the Biden Justice Department of weaponizing itself to go after a political opponent.
A lot of people will bring up, sorry, Travis, a lot of people will bring up the fact that, you know, Mike Pence brought home classified documents. President Biden has found classified documents at his various homes. What is different about the way the former President Trump and these documents at his Mar-a-Lago resort?
Well, it seems the key difference is the way that the former president handled the government's efforts to get the documents back. Remember, the National Archives was working with the former president in early 2022 to retrieve these documents that were missing. And the former president was going back and forth with the lawyers, and at some point, 15 boxes were turned over. They included classified materials, and so there was this haggling that was going on. At some point last spring, about a year ago, a subpoena was issued by the Justice Department to the former president demanding the return of all classified materials that might be in his possession. The former president had his attorneys certify in writing that he had no more classified material in his possession. But then the Justice Department came into information, it seems, through an informant or other evidence, that in fact the former president was still keeping classified material in his possession. That led to the raid on Mar-a-Lago last August. The FBI pulled out 100 documents with classified markings, and that is going to be, it seems, used by prosecutors as evidence of intent to obstruct justice and obstruct the investigation, and to secrete or retain classified materials that they're going to argue the former president knew he shouldn't have had in his possession. And that's a key difference, because it seems as we look at the cases of whether it's Hillary Clinton. Let me set the Hillary Clinton email case aside for a moment. But when you look at the cases of Joe Biden and Mike Pence, the indication we've gotten both from the former vice presidents, plural in those cases, and the Justice Department is that it was viewed as an inadvertent mistake. At least that's the determination they made in Pence's case. I think the Biden case is still outstanding, but that's the argument that the former vice president, current president, is making when it comes to the documents at Wilmington. But what is missing from those cases, which is seemingly apparent in the Trump case, is an effort to put off prosecutors and refuse to cooperate with an allegation that he knowingly held these documents, knowing he shouldn't have them.
I mean, you brought up the Hillary Clinton emails. Let's talk about that, because that is obviously something that the former president has used multiple times. And Republican operatives and supporters of the president have pointed to as well. Folks have said, well, you know, look what happened with Comey, the former FBI director, not referring charges in that case. Why are they different?
Well, it's a fair question. And I think in the Hillary Clinton case, you start, right, because that case seems to have been disposed. You start with the idea that the server was set up to evade the Freedom of Information Act, so there wouldn't be a government storage of these emails. It was government work, but it was done on a private server, so the former Secretary of State then could decide what she wanted to share with the government ultimately for government record keeping. Because it was a server that was used for government work, there was determined to be some classified material on that server, and then that server was destroyed, physically destroyed, and the software was bleached and all this. And so that has been used by the former president, Donald Trump, in his political argument that there's some sort of double standard or unfair treatment here. I can't speak for the Justice Department or explain away the decisions that were made. James Comey has been roundly criticized for making a statement as the head of the FBI, which is an investigative agency, as opposed to the Justice Department, which makes charging decisions. The FBI director at the time asserted himself as sort of an arbiter of all this, which almost everyone says he shouldn't have done, because it's not up to the FBI to decide whether someone has actually committed a crime. It's prosecutors who go forward with charging decisions. But suffice it to say, Hillary Clinton was not charged with a crime, and Donald Trump is. But what is missing in the what is an element in the Trump case, which I think is what prosecutors are going to highlight here, is that they believe they have evidence. It seems they have evidence. And we haven't seen it yet, but we've read about it, that the former president talked about the fact that he had documents he shouldn't have had and walled off those documents, put them in a certain place so they could be hidden away. And this may wind up ultimately coming out in open court, as the former president is tried with multiple federal felonies.
Stephen, we only have about a minute here, but I want to ask you about reaction to this. We've been reading the political reaction. I'm seeing Republicans come to maybe not defend the president, but point to the process and say that the process is corrupt and that it's the Biden administration's fault here. But I want to ask you about Trump supporters. I mean, there's always concern about violent rhetoric. I mean, will we see anything in response to this? Could we see protests? Could we see violence? What are you hearing about that? Obviously, it's early in this process, but wondering what we're hearing initially.
I don't know. I have no idea whether violence could be sparked by something like this. I think that what you are hearing from certain members of the Republican nominating contest is, you know, you have people like Asa Hutchinson, who are clearly in the anti-Trump lane, saying that this is another example why he shouldn't be given the trust of and confidence of voters. And then you have others who are perhaps, you know, closer to defeating the former president, who say that this is an example of Justice Department run amok. I mean, that's the argument you're hearing from Ron DeSantis. When it comes to the overall temperature, some of the candidates are working to bring it down. Others are not.
CBS correspondent Stephen Portnoy, I always appreciate your perspective on these political issues. We'll be talking to you, I'm sure, as this plays out. Thank you.
You bet.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness now, brought to you by Robert W. Baird. A young Brooklyn, New York girl received an invitation to the White House following her continued acts of kindness in her community.
Because I just can't let people just suffer and die like that. Somebody needs to help one another.
Powerful words coming from the mouth of 7-year-old Jewel Alexis Josie, who from a young age knew her purpose.
At 5 years old and 4, I decided that I should make a change in the world by giving food to the hungry, clothes to the naked.
And she did just that by launching a nonprofit, Where Love Wins, along with her mother, who tells Cheddar News.
It was out of the blue. She woke up and she said, "Mommy, I got a vision." And she was adamant until today.
The young girl spends her time hosting food and coat drives, as well as thanking police officers for keeping the neighborhood safe.
I just don't want to see any fighting, no more chokeholds, no more knifing or gun violence.
Her determination garnered the attention of local officials at the national level, too. She was first invited to the White House National Day of Prayer in 2020. And this year, she's been invited again, not just to speak, but also to sing.
You are condemned.
It feels really good because, you see, as I'm starting to grow up as a big girl, I'm just saying that I need to help the community.
She's 7.
Oh, my gosh.
Invited to the White House twice.
Yeah.
What an inspiration. Kids always are.
They know best.
Mm-hmm.
They know what's right.
Yeah, they do.
Welcome back to Seattle's Morning News. Now from the Gian Ursula Show, every weekday here on Cairo News Radio 9 to noon. The one, the only, the amazing Ursula Roy team.
Good morning. Good morning. I heard we're going to talk about ice cream and lawsuits.
Mm. I like ice cream.
Me
too. I don't want to sue anybody, but I like ice cream. So bring us up to speed here. Molly Moons is suing the city of Seattle, claiming that the decision to withdraw police, fire, and other emergency services from Capitol Hill's organized protest, the CHOP zone,
yes,
a number of years ago, led to huge revenue losses for them. So they're suing.
Yes. And I know that there are going to be people who say, well, isn't that especially rich? Because Molly Moon, the owner, was also the same person who said, essentially, this is a gun-free zone. We don't want police officers here if they don't take off their arms. And, you know, everyone who was very supportive of police took that as insulting. Police were upset about it. And now here is this lawsuit. So I want to make sure that everyone knows, yes, we realize that is the same owner. Yeah. And isn't there an irony there? But this is going to be basically the legacy of the person who said this.
We could have the summer of love.
Yeah. Former mayor.
She will
Jenny
never live
Durkin.
That down.
No, ever live
she
that
will
down.
Not live that down. And so this lawsuit is just the latest in the basically what the city of Seattle is going to end up having to pay out for the abysmal failure of that particular administration. The CHOP zone was crazy.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of people are still just kind of trying to wrap their brains over the idea that an entire section of the city of Seattle was given up for these protests. I don't know how you guys...
And they're still not back in that precinct. Like, that police precinct is just still...
Empty?
No.
Yeah. No, did they move back in there?
No. The East Precinct is back. The chop zone lasted for almost a month.
Yeah. Right around that Cal Anderson area. I remember one of our former employees, Miley Katie, she lived right there in an apartment, and she said it sounded like a war zone every night.
Well,
she was sort of our reporter boots on the ground from her balcony apartment filming it. It was absolutely nuts. I think in the beginning we thought, like, okay, let's everybody get their, you know, protesting out of the way. But once they started occupying and setting up barriers and the city supported it, it got out of hand, and then nobody could quell the violence. It was too big.
And there was eventually violence. Extreme violence.
Yeah.
Two people died. So those families are suing. The city of Seattle has already paid out millions of dollars to other businesses. So will she prevail? Will Molly Moon prevail? Probably, because, again, what happened was unprecedented and was just an abject failure of leadership, starting with Jenny Durkin.
Has anybody asked her if this is going to reach class action status? Because she's not the only business in what was the chop zone.
Has anyone asked Molly?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, she's going this alone. I think everyone's going to try to get their money.
Yeah,
basically. And they see that the city of Seattle is not going to have much of an argument. Again, the only thing that, you know, might work against Molly Moon in particular is, wait, would you have allowed police to actually? And I think if we get the politics out of there, of course, she wanted police and fire to have access to her business, and she wasn't able to have business, is what she's claiming. And I think there are going to be a lot of business owners and people who live in that area who will be able to sue.
I'm wondering, if we transition a little bit up to Molly Moon is also recently removing tipping from the business model.
Oh, yeah.
That's
so we had her on our show just recently, and she explained that because she said it shouldn't be up to the customers to make up, I believe, she said, in paying a livable wage for my employees. So I think they were, you know, in the $20 an hour range for, you know, to start and going up from there. Now, I will say that I went on Glassdoor and a couple of other company review sites, and there were people who work for Molly Moon who were complaining, saying, well, now that took off like $5 an hour for me, because, you know, as a customer and someone who occasionally does go into Molly Moon, I love the fact that I don't have to now feel compelled to tip on already kind of expensive ice cream.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But for the people who work there, it's, you know, she offers a lot of other benefits too. I mean, I think she's very progressive in terms of what she offers her employees, but not everyone is, you know, totally happy with the no tipping thing other than customers.
It is interesting, though. Businesses are moving in this direction. I live in the Montlake neighborhood, and we have a new bakery, Oxbow Bakery. They're doing this now. Fuel, which is the coffee shop chain, they're doing that now. Like, there are not cafes in our little business district that now allow tipping. There is no tipping in Montlake.
Seriously?
Yeah. I mean, it's a tiny little neighborhood, but like, there's not a... There are no tips.
America's unique in that. Yeah. I remember trying to tip when I was in Europe last year, and they're like, you Americans, you just like to throw your money at people. And, you know, they refuse to take it. You know, if somebody handed me $10 and I didn't expect a tip, I'd be like, thank you. It's an insult where it's like, no,
in some cases,
my job.
It is an insult, but they're also paid a whole lot more and they get a whole lot more vacation too.
Yeah.
In Europe.
Absolutely. Yeah, they do, right? And siestas and all that.
Ursula Roytine going to be taking the mic here at 9 a.m. to noon.
With Mike Lewis, too.
Fun. Yes. It'll be a fun show today.
It'll be a fresh Friday.
Disney does not hide its support of the LGBTQ community, even criticizing Florida, the home of Disney World, for its Don't Say Gay bill. This year, Disney has teamed up with choirs for a pride concert, and the Seattle Men's Chorus is among the first in the country to perform it. Cairo News Radio's Heather Bosch reports.
Disney Disney music swells to the rafters of a church where the Seattle Men's Chorus is practicing for its Pride performance. Chorus member Luke Preston Toogood.
Well, I don't think there's a person, you know, in my general vicinity that didn't grow up singing and loving at least one, two, three, or all the Disney movies, you know?
The program features music from Disney movies and theme parks. There's even a sing-along. Much of this is downright delightful, but
this isn't just about being happy and joyful and Disney fun. It is about taking you through the myriad of emotions that you can go through in one show, and it's kind of breathtaking.
Disney has been part of all of our lives.
Seattle Men's Chorus Executive Director Craig Coogan.
Their characters always have a struggle. They always have something that they're trying to aspire to. And isn't that exactly what all of us are trying to do? But especially people who identify in the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community.
One chorus member who has struggled is Steve Morose. He served as an officer in the U.S. Air Force in the 1980s, long before the military allowed openly LGBTQ individuals to serve.
They court-martialed me and put me in prison for 2 years.
2 years behind bars at Fort Leavenworth for being himself.
I used it as my jump, as my springboard into being an out proud gay man. So I left Fort Leavenworth knowing I would never ever deny who I was again.
Morose is one of several chorus members who will be sharing their stories as part of the Pride performance. And while in his message he warns that some states are trying to roll back LGBTQ rights,
the part that heartens me is knowing that all the polls say 70-80% of Americans support gay marriage, and the vast majority of people think this stuff is silly, you know, and the anti-drag and anti-trans movement is only gaining ground in some places, but there will be a backlash. People have accepted us as family members, as friends, as members of their community, because we are. And now that we have revealed ourselves, there's no going back. And why would we?
Heather Bosch, Cairo News Radio.
The Seattle Men Chorus performs Disney Pride in concert tonight and tomorrow at the Paramount Theater.
Back to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Travis Mayfield in for Dave Ross, along with our show producer, David Burbank. Now, we're both runners. I think looking at you, David, I would say, yeah, you look like a runner. You're tall, you're lean, you're lanky, you're in good shape. I think looking at me, I don't know if that's true. I'm short, I'm fat, I'm old. I don't know if I look like a runner. But who should run? And who can run? And who can call themselves a runner? Martinez Evans, author of this new book, Slow AF Run Club, joining us now this morning. Martinez, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You have a really fascinating story of how you came to be a runner. Walk us through how you became a runner.
10 years ago, I was working at Men's Warehouse and I developed some hip pain. So I'm on my feet 12 hours a day in hard bottom dress shoes. I developed some hip issues. And I go see a doctor about this hip pain. And as I'm sitting in the doctor's office and I'm telling him all this stuff, like, hey, doc, got this hip pain. I'm on my feet. I used to play football. He's like, oh, I know why you're in pain. Okay, why is that, doc? It's because you're fat. And not only are you fat, but you need to lose weight. And if you don't, you're going to die.
Oh, yikes.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's not what you want the doctor to say to you.
Exactly. Especially when, like, you're there for a hip thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We get into a heated debate, argument, some people would say, and me facetiously saying, you know what? I'm going to run a marathon.
You said that to him?
Yes.
I love it.
And he laughs at me and tells me that's dumb.
And you use that as fuel.
Yes.
Yes.
I use that as fuel.
And now how many marathons have you run?
I've ran 8 marathons.
Including Boston.
Including Boston.
Martinez, would you train with someone? Is there a person that you would like, that was kind of a mentor to you, that showed you how to get to the place that you wanted to be at?
No, unfortunately not. I had to, this journey was a very lonely journey. I did everything by myself to the point where at the beginning of my journey, I couldn't even find a coach that would train me. A lot of coaches was like, you know, you're bigger or larger than what I'm typically used to training. And I don't want to be responsible if you get injured or hurt yourself. I don't want to be responsible for that. So I ended up having to buy every single running book I could get my hands on, reading all those things, getting a run coach certification just so I can train myself.
Which leads us to your book. I mean, that's basically what this is it's a manual for anybody who wants to step out the door and become a runner. Because I preach this constantly. If you step out the door and you move your feet in front of you and you want to call yourself a runner, you are a runner. But your book really does this in a brilliant kind of way with honesty. I mean, there's some stuff in here that's just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you went through that. And then some humor as well. I mean, do you see this as like a guidebook for folks?
Yes, this is a guidebook. This is a guidebook that I wish I would have had when I started running more than 10 years ago.
Give us some idea of what we would get if we are going to pick up this book and you're going to help us get out the door.
Alrighty. Y'all ready for this?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. This book here is, like I said, the book, the guide that I wish I had. Imagine going to a friend and they say, friend, I want to run. Can you please help me? And that friend is like, hey, you got 10 hours. I'll tell you everything I need to know. And that friend goes on to tell you about form and gives you a very interesting story about what he learned about it, or talk about nutrition. And then shares a story of the pitfalls that he fell through when talking about nutrition, mindset, finding a running community, cross training, recovery. All of this stuff is inside of this book, and it's written in a way that is very digestible, entertaining, witty. This book is going to make you laugh. This book is going to make you angry, and this book is going to make you cry.
I know, Martinez, as a white man running, I have never once had to worry about what time of day I'm running, where I'm running. It's one of these opportunities where I really have to check my privilege. Can you speak on having to run as a person of color and sort of what some of those struggles have been for you?
As a person of color, it has been multiple times where the police have been called on me. I've been slammed on countless police hoods. I've been handcuffed.
Because you were running? You were just a black man running.
Yes. Imagine on a 20-mile marathon training run. It's 5 a.m. because you got to get up at 5 a.m. to run 20 miles.
Yep.
You got your headlight on. You got your hydration vest on. And you're running in the street. You got your headlight on so you can see what's out there. Mm. And then the police will pull alongside of me, see what I'm doing, turn the lights on, and just stop me and question me about what I'm doing out here. Why am I, you know, out in these times of the day and things of that sort? And my answer is like, I'm running. Like, look at me. Like, I have a headlight on. I got this hydration vest on. You really think I'm like committing crimes? This is one of the reasons why my merch is the way that it is with the turtles and the paisley, because I want officers who plan to stop me when I say, hey, look at me. I am in a turtle outfit. You really think I'm going to commit crimes?
I can't imagine, for one, sort of having to be consciously and constantly aware of that. I know a big part of running for me, a big thing that motivates me is listening to music, listening to podcasts. Like, it's a good way for me to sort of dive into my mind, think about things, be able to listen to music that I really enjoy. Is that a thing that you're able to still indulge in while you're running, or do you feel like you have to kind of be constantly vigilant?
It's a mixture of both. So, you know, I run with one headphone in, like one ear pod in, or I even run with those bone conductive headphones as well. But it is one of the things I even talk about in the book, of keeping your head on a swivel and just being vigilant about your surroundings, vigilant about the people that you see, vigilant about body languages and all the things to play, right? Because you never know, as a person of color, you know, you might run down the wrong street or the wrong neighborhood and something bad may happen. And I even think about, you know, the death of Ahmaud Arbery. Like, that broke me as a person of color who's a runner, right? And I almost quit running because of that.
So what drives you to continue? Is it the love of running?
Yes, I think the love of running is one of the things that drives me, right? I personally know that I am a better Martinez when I'm physically active. I'm a better Martinez when I'm training for races. I'm a better Martinez when I have goals and routines that I focus on a regular basis. The other thing is that the people, you couldn't even think of the amount of joy that people get when they see my big butt out there running and doing the thing, right? It gives people hope that they also can be active and love themselves in the skin that they're in.
Martinez Evans, author of the new book, Slow AF Run Club, with a really inspirational story and lots of really great advice for runners, for non-runners, for anybody who just wants to be active. We appreciate your time this morning, Martinez.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.